Well, as Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, head of the enterprisemission.com, always says, show me the data. Tonight, a special coast-to-coast program, Afterlife Encounters, going beyond the data with stories that will truly fascinate you. Our special guest, Diane Archangel. She's next on Coast to Coast AM. Diane Archangel is a former hospice chaplain, psychiatric hospital therapist, and director of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Center of Houston. She served on the board of directors at the Rhine Research Center and at the National Institute for Discovery Science, where she also led trainings and conducted research. She is the author of Afterlife Encounters, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Experiences, Life After Loss. Diane currently conducts survival research with the University of Virginia. She's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Diane. How are you?
I'm great, George. How are you?
You're wonderful. I got to tell you, I love your last name.
Well,
I mean,
is that
your real name, or do you use that just to write?
No, that is my real name. In fact, a lot of people think that it's a pen name, but it isn't. It's actually my husband's name. It's very common in Italy. When we went to Rome, there were about 3.5 pages in the Rome phone book with archangels.
Well, this weekend I had so many people asking me about Sunday night's program, and they said, all right, who's the guest? What are you going to talk about? And I said, well, her name's Diane Archangel. We're going to talk about afterlife encounters. And they were more interested in hearing about your name. But it is.
People start to sign up for my survey, and they'll say, I really would like to participate in this, but come on now. What's with the name?
Tell me about the survey, because I'm getting people who are sending me email copies of what they filled out on your website.
Yes, and I am thrilled, George. I've just had so many people have been submitting their surveys. It's just a real simple 6-question survey about ecstasy. Ecstasy is extraordinary joy. And most of the people who have taken it reported that their afterlife encounters brought them ecstasy. And all are far cries from the fearful media portrayals. You know, right now, especially in the media, we see so much on television and movies. Those accounts are fiction. Writers often begin with genuine accounts, but since real afterlife encounters are always positive, writers sensationalize them. You know, let's face it, fear sells. So most of what the public knows about afterlife encounters is taught to them by the media.
That's true.
So what I'm trying to do is get back into teaching the public what are afterlife encounters. And I'm hoping that we can do this with this survey.
Now, the kind of response that you get from people with those results, how many people do you need in order to really begin to weigh the accuracy of this?
As far as weighing the accuracy, we think that somewhere between anything over 25 participants. However, George, I have had over 200 just since you put my website on your website.
Oh, and now that we're asking for people to take it, you're going to get flooded, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, you have a huge following.
The website, of course.
We met. You won't remember this because I was only one of about 200 people standing there in line. But you and I both were signing books at the Book Expo in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
2 years ago. You were there with your co-author, William Burns, for Worker in the Light, and you were signing copies. So, of course, like I said, you won't remember me. I was one of 200 people fighting to get in to see you.
I promised you that you'd get on Coast to Coast, and you've been on with Art and now with me. We remember these things.
Well, I didn't think you would.
As a matter of fact, your voice also, I sound like I'm interviewing Reese Witherspoon, the actress. Very similar voice. She must be from your neck of the woods.
Well, thank you so much. I believe she is. I'm in Houston, Texas.
I'll have you do some impressions on the Walk the Line movie.
Oh, boy.
You don't sing, do you?
Oh, unfortunately not.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you, Diane, get involved in work as a hospice chaplain and, ending up working with the Rhine Research Center and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Center? How did that all happen for you?
It unfolded. It just seemed like it just fell on my lap. It actually being as far as my hospice work, I had I lost a lot of blood relatives in a very short period of time. My parents, my sister-in-law took her own life. Just an awful lot of loss. So when I went to the hospice, I wanted to, you know, George, I never wanted somebody else to die the way I had seen my relatives die.
Right,
I never wanted any family member to have to go it alone the way I did. And I thought with hospice, at least I could find some place where I could do my own mourning, and hopefully I could find a place, which I did, where people don't die in the kind of pain that I experienced with my family. One thing led to another while I was there. I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, began working with her, and it opened up an entire field for me of afterlife studies. Now, I had been studying, really, the afterlife since I was 6 years old. But as far as formally going into a university and beginning study, I didn't until I began working with Elizabeth.
6 years old?
6 years old.
What happened as a six-year-old to get you interested in afterlife encounters?
Well, it's the first story in my book, and it goes back to my very first day of school. Now, I was a brand-new six-year-old, meaning I had just had my sixth birthday. Started into school, and the teacher asked us to stand up and say something about ourselves. Well, little Jimmy was sitting in the front of the room, hopping up and down, me, me, me. He began trying to tell the teacher and the classroom about his grandpa, who had come to him after death to visit. But the teacher, oh, scolded, oh, sit down, don't be silly, don't be stupid. He was, but I'm not. I'm just trying to talk about my grandpa. He came to see me. Oh, what do you mean? Don't be silly. Sit down. I felt so sorry for little Jimmy. He was so downtrodden that in the lunch break, I made sure to listen to his story. And it was very brief, just about his grandpa. And he came and said hi, and they waved. Well, when I went home that evening, I was telling my parents around the dinner table. My dad came to me later that evening and told me about my Uncle Harry. Now, this, like I said, these stories are in the book, and they're very long, but just as an overview.
Sure.
My Uncle Harry, my dad, my Aunt Lou, and my mother went to the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. Now, my Uncle Harry was not blood relative. He was married to my aunt. So while they were at the fair, my dad said they saw things that they had never seen before in their lives, new music, new food. There were also, along the boardwalk, there were these fortune tellers. Well, one began to call out to my Uncle Harry, 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 come here. Of course, my mother and aunt were just elbowing one another and laughing, but then said, how in the world could she know your name? But she kept calling out, Harry, Harry. My Uncle Harry kept walking on down the boardwalk. Then she said, come here, I have something to tell you. Your wife, Ernestine, is here and wants to talk to you. Well, Dad said my Uncle Harry turned around, turned white as a sheet, walked inside this tent where she had the table set up, and there she gave him a description of his wife with long black hair, their baby also with long black hair, and how she was very sorry for what she had done, not only to him, but to both of she and the baby. Now, this just sounds ridiculous. My dad said that just, my Uncle Harry had never been married before. No one knew. But when they went home that night, they went all the way back to Michigan. My Uncle Harry asked my dad to come back the next day. They went downstairs into the basement. And there, my Uncle Harry pulled out a photograph from an old, old black, just a faded envelope.
Yeah.
Pulled out this locket, and in it was a photograph of Ernestine, and told my dad that that was his first wife, that shortly after their baby was born, she had taken her own life and his. But, George, nobody knew that. Nobody. So my dad began to say, well, maybe she knew you, maybe she had seen you. But he said, no, they were from way, way up north. I believe it was in Canada, and he told the trip about how they made it back down, and he never wanted anybody to know about this, and he never wanted to be reminded again. But here she was at the World's Fair, this fortune teller, giving him exact details, even the description of his wife and baby.
That must have just blown his mind when all that happened.
Oh, my dad said he just, but my dad said the important thing, honey, is We don't know what happens after death. We don't know if she really was in touch with his first wife. But what's important is he got his life back. Until then, he was very sad. He was very sullen. He was just gloomy all the time. They just thought it was his personality. But he said after that, did you see your Uncle Harry now? He comes home whistling from work. He's a completely different person. So he said what's important is not whether these are internal or external or whether they're real or not, but what they do for us, how they change our lives.
The perception. You know, we'll get into some of the data tonight, Diane, as well, because I've always believed, even though scientists, a lot of them won't admit this, that there's a science and a spirituality about what you do. Afterlife encounters, I think, bridges that gap.
Thank you. I hope it does. That's what I was wanting to do, was to bridge that gap between science and faith.
So as a little six-year-old, you begin to get this exposure to afterlife encounters. Did it go away and come back, or was this an obsession with a little girl and it just grew into where you are now?
It became an obsession. It was something that was just so profound to me and so mind-boggling. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to know why, how, when, where, the purpose. I wanted to know everything that I could possibly gather, like a sponge. I was this little bitty girl, and like a sponge, I began to just absorb everything that I could.
Do you remember the very first funeral you went to where a body was laid out in a casket?
Oh, good question. The very first funeral that I can remember going to, I certainly do, is my grandpa's.
And what were your feelings about that? Do you remember?
What a great question. Actually, I do vaguely remember now that you mention it. Now, this was many, many years ago. But yes, I was sure that his spirit had survived. That body was just there, but his spirit had survived.
I don't remember my first one. I think it could have been a friend of mine. When we graduated from high school, we had a group of buddies, and this one, his name was Stephen Balog. I'll always remember, in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. And we had all just graduated from school, and he and another buddy of mine signed up to join the Air Force. And they were all happy and glee, and they were driving. Steve had a Volkswagen, and the next thing we heard, Diane, was that Steve was in a car accident by himself, hit another car, and he was tossed through the windshield, and he was dead instantly. And now that I think about it, it was his funeral that was my very first that I went and actually looked at a body. And I'd never done that before. I was 18 years old. And I remember seeing him looking all waxy and pasty looking. I knew it was him, but it didn't look like him. And I just said, you know what? It truly, his life has been taken out of this body, this shell, whatever he might have been in. And it was pretty profound for me at that time.
And I would imagine at 18, that's just the age that we're really understanding what death is, that it's permanent, it can happen to us.
And I don't like them, by the way. I don't like going to funerals. Not that there's anything scary about it or anything like that. I don't like, you know, seeing the incredible sadness that surrounds it. You know, even though, you know, some of the Irish folks, they'll have one heck of a wake for somebody. By and large, the few funerals that I've now gone to are kind of sad. I mean, people are just broken down. They're sobbing and, you know, remembering the person they cared about. So I don't like them that much. Is that wrong for me? I feel comfortable with these. What do you think?
I wouldn't say wrong, but as a hospice chaplain, I had done a number of funerals, in fact, quite a few funerals. And what we try to do, somebody that has done a lot of funerals or does the proceedings, is that we want to celebrate the life, yet we also want to be really in touch with reality that physically that person we will never have a touch, we will never see them again in the physical, we'll never hug, we'll never sit down and drink a cup of coffee with them or whatever, but the physical aspect is gone, and that we need to grieve for. But if we can just celebrate the life and the continuation of life, and I think with so many funerals, that's what's left out.
Well, that's true. And when you have practice hospice, who's it for primarily? The person who's about to die or his family?
Both. That's a great question, George. Hospice is for both. It's for the person who has a terminal illness, but it's also very supportive of family. In fact, most hospices follow the family for 1 year if the family agrees and would like that service. They provide a service free of charge for 1 year after the death.
What was for you probably the most engaging thing someone who was about ready to die ever shared with you?
Oh, gosh, what a great question. The most engaging thing that someone...
who was ready to depart ever told you while you were doing your hospice?
This may sound really, I don't know, not exactly the what you're thinking it would be, but there was a minister who, when I went to his house and would visit with him, we would usually have a prayer. And with hospice chaplains, let me say, because this is very misunderstood, is that it's not religion, it's spiritual. We support people spiritually. It
right.
Doesn't matter if they're atheist, if they're Buddhist, if they're Christian, it doesn't matter. We're just there to support them. So if they want a prayer, that's fine, and they're Christian, we do that. So I was having a prayer with him, and which is what I usually did week after week. But then finally we reached a point that he said, as I was getting ready to go, I said, would you like for me to say a prayer with you? And he said, you just did. And I said, what do you mean I just did? And he said, you don't need to make a prayer like a big hullabaloo talking. He said, people really get at a spiritual level where we are coming from with one another. When you just say, I'll be thinking about you, you are saying a prayer for that person. And I've always remembered that. It stuck with me that when we say goodbye and we reach out and we hug or we shake a hand, that in effect is a prayer. We're saying goodbye and we're sharing our love and we're saying blessings to one another.
Well, I can't wait to get into, we're really going to dissect afterlife encounters, because we'll talk about the data, we'll talk about some of the stories, and we'll also get your views on what you think just might be on the other side. Are you happy or disappointed with how most people look at afterlife encounters?
That's a boy, you are really full of great questions this evening. Am I happy with the way most people look at them? I would say, now, of course, this goes back to my surveys, that the people who take the surveys, which have been, like the surveys that were based on my book, Afterlife Encounters, there were over 6,000 people internationally who took that survey. And of those people, most all of them said they were comforting, they helped with grief. In fact, 87% rated them in the highest comfort level.
That's pretty high. Stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment with Diane Archangel, Afterlife Encounters. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Diane Archangel, her book, Afterlife Encounters. Now tell us specifically, what is an afterlife encounter, Diane?
All right. An afterlife encounter is any sense of being connected to or in the presence of a discarnate personality. When I say any sense, it can be visual, it can be auditory, we may feel a cool breeze, we may reach out and feel a touch, or it's just that sixth sense of knowing beyond a doubt that someone is there with us.
Now, when these events occur, and people have these encounters, how many times is it conjured up by the individual or it just simply happens?
That, in other words, you're wanting to know if they're internal or external?
Okay, I guess you could call it that.
Okay, as far as whether someone is conjuring up themselves or whether it's like an internal generated event, George, we don't really know scientifically, and perhaps it was generated by the person themselves, but then when they put the energy out, they connect with something greater and far beyond them. I mean, scientifically speaking, we don't know if we'll ever prove afterlife encounters are authentic and genuine and external. However, there's this huge, huge body of evidence that they certainly are.
Now, when you say we don't know if we're going to be able to prove it, is that because we just don't have any physical evidence to prove it?
It's because it seems that science is always going to find some type of alternative explanation for what could be other than a genuine account.
Explain that a little bit more for me.
All right. Well, for instance, in my book, one entire chapter is focused on afterlife encounters, the evidence. I listed six conditions whereby we consider this evidence for survival. Well, of the first three, the scientists will come out and they'll say, well, but those events already happened. And everything that's ever been happened, any word that's been said, any event that's ever occurred, is still out in the universe. So it's just a matter of someone tapping into that information that's out there. So I said, all right, so we're going to take this further then. We'll go into the future. What if an apparition can come and give us future information? So I've tried to address all of these other alternative explanations that scientists give us in that one chapter. But now I've done that, and they're saying, well, scratching their heads and saying, you know, we can't explain it, but they're looking.
Those people who generally believe in afterlife encounters, are they more spiritual than those people who don't believe in much, skeptics, for example?
That's another great question. And actually, I address that in the book, is that, well, for instance, there were people who took my surveys who didn't even believe in life after death at the time that they had encounters. They weren't longing for them. They didn't believe in them. They said, this just can't be. I don't even believe that there's anything after we physically die. But yet they had these afterlife encounters.
What are some of the things you asked in order to solicit people for the survey? I mean, what were you looking for?
I was looking for, did it affect their grief? There was one section that completely was focused on their grief. Did it affect it, and if so, for how long? We also looked at comfort. Did it bring them comfort, and to what extent? Had they ever had an afterlife encounter before? Were they bereaved? 8% of the people who took the survey were not bereaved. 82% said they had never longed for anything like that. And what I found interesting, that 28% of the survey respondents had nothing close to an afterlife encounter ever in their entire life. Yet they said they had an intense and extended longing. They just, more than anything, they wished they could. Now, 28% of the people had never had anything, but yet they longed for them. So we really tried to look at many facets of what exactly is going on here.
And, but some people don't like talking about the subject. It's a no-no to them. Why is that?
That's true. I'll tell you what, it is so taboo. For one thing, it's just basically fear of the unknown. And the media does not help with, like I mentioned earlier, most of their portrayals are fiction. The movies, the TVs, most of what we see, they may begin with just a little bit of a genuine account, but fear sells, so they blow it way up. So most of what the public knows about afterlife encounters is taught to them by the media.
Well, we see things like the Amityville Horror and other things like The Exorcist, and we are petrified of what's on the other side, right?
That's absolutely true. And I'll tell you, George, not any of my colleagues, nor I have even one case of anything close to like we see, like the Amityville horrors. There's no, we have no earthbound spirits. We have nothing trapped between worlds, no vengeful spirits, nothing even like what we see in the media. I have over 13,000 documented accounts in my files, and nothing like that.
Yet demons exist, don't they?
If, I always say evil is of this world, simply because we probably, with my colleagues collectively, we probably have an easy, well over 100,000 cases. And we don't have anything demonic. We don't have anything evil. Now, one of my colleagues, Bill Rowe, you may know Bill Rowe, is well known. In fact, he's internationally known as Mr. Poltergeist. He came over here from Europe along with J.B. Ryan, with the Ryan Research Center. Bill is in his 80s now, and he is Mr. Poltergeist. He is the expert in poltergeist. And he says in every case that he has gone in and studied, it goes back to usually as a teenager, she's usually female, and it's someone with some type of an emotional problem, something either a divorce in the family, they've moved, changed locations, but there's something going on that creates this energy, but it's all internally generated. It has nothing to do with anything outside of that teenager.
Well, now, what would you say to the exorcists with, let's say, the Catholic Church?
Again, it goes back to, well, if it helps the person, and we can think of it, say, as therapy, and it helps the person who says or that feels that she's possessed, then that's, you know, it's a form of treatment. But as far as scientifically ever gathering any kind of data, I don't have any. My colleagues don't have any. I'm sure someone out there has information, or they have talked to someone, or they believe that person is possessed. But having worked in a psych hospital, you know, there's multiple personality disorders. There's all sorts of disorders. Psychiatric evaluations tell us something is wrong. There's some type of emotional, cognitive, something going on with the person usually. Some type of issue.
But you mean it be, with these thousands of people that participated in the survey, not one said, you know, there are demons out there?
Not one. Now, some people were fearful. In fact, one of the stories in the book was from a grandmother whose grandson appeared to her. She hid under the sheet and shook and shook and vibrated. And then after a while, she came out and said, "What on earth was I doing?" And then she wished and she prayed she could have another. She wanted to talk to him. And so many people say that. At first, it's so startling. And we have such fear base. We're taught this fear that at first we're just like, oh, and pull away. In fact, there are a number of stories in the book where somebody and jerked and pulled and pushed back. But then they realize, oh, no, that was their fear. And they wished and prayed they could have another. And in one study, 50% of the people did have another.
Well, I guess when you say fear, you know, if I'm sitting in my car and I see a dearly departed one sitting in the back seat, I don't think it would frighten me, but it would scare me. I mean, two different kinds of forms, I guess, of emotion. It would be a little jarring, I think, to see a dead person's spirit in the back seat of your car, wouldn't it?
I would think so, too. It's startling, anyway.
And is that what you mean by fear?
What I mean by fear is, there's the startle response, like with the grandmother who saw her deceased grandson. Now, that's more of a startle. And, yeah, she was fearful at the time.
Or seeing the person, the apparition in the back seat of your car.
Yes.
That's a startled fear.
Some people would be startled. Some people would be fearful. I would be startled. But like you said, I mean, I don't think that any of us, unless we've had the experience before, would if we encountered someone sitting in the back seat, we wouldn't feel some type of a startle response. I mean, just the thing of it being a completely foreign experience to us.
Is there anything to fear?
Really, there isn't. There's absolutely nothing to fear.
Give me one of your stories out of afterlife encounters, which would kind of echo this part of the topic we're talking about.
All right. As far as anything to fear, let me give you an example with Deanna Dubay. Deanna lives in Hollywood still. In fact, she's one of the few people that I asked for a story for my book. Most of the people had either taken the survey or they would say, I want my story out there helping someone. Please write a book. But Deanna, I had met years and years ago, and she told me about living in Hollywood and meeting this movie star. Now, in the book, she had to change his name for privacy.
Okay.
But after he died, he came to Deanna. Now, Deanna wasn't startled. And she said it's because when she was very, very young, she had several encounters. But see, she's young and she didn't have that fear base yet. She wasn't taught, like now we're taught as we grow up. But no one had told her this is something to fear. So when this famous person came to her and said, you've got to go and help me. I'm trying to find my two friends and tell them that I'm okay. And he had a very personal message for these two ladies. Deanna had never heard of either woman before. She searched, she looked them up, she finally found one. The other was all the way across the world in England, but brought them back, gave both of these ladies a message, very personal, private message, and both acknowledged, yes, they knew what he was talking about, and indeed, that was true. But there's an example that here was someone Deanna didn't really know. She had happened upon him one time, but yet she didn't have that fear because she wasn't taught as a little girl to fear it.
How much of this, though, is faith-based as opposed to knowledge, I guess?
It really depends on the individual. I believe a lot of it is faith-based simply because we're raised with it. A religion tells us, the dead have their world, the living has ours, and those two don't mix. But yet we're taught that the soul, the spirit continues. It lives forever. It's eternal.
When you were putting together the afterlife encounters, was there one episode there that was, I guess, the one that you'd remember more than anything?
I'll tell you, George, there are so many stories in the book, and it's kind of interesting how different people write and they tell me their favorite stories. But the one that sticks with me more than any of the others, in fact, I'll be really honest with you, it's one of the main reasons I wrote the book, is I'm trying to help a mother. It's a cold case. Her name is Beverly, and her son, Tommy, came to her and told her one morning where she would find his blood in the snow. Now, here's what's important. Tommy was killed in Brooklyn.
Oh, my.
The police came to her and said, there's no crime scene, will be no witnesses, there'll be no suspects, because Tommy's body was moved. He was killed somewhere else. We found him in Brooklyn in a van. So Tommy came to her early, early one morning and said, Mom, get up, hurry, hurry. You've got to rush right now. And told her exactly where to go. And this is in my book, and I forgot the exact corner. But
now, she had already known he was dead, right?
Before
that happened? Okay.
Right. This was after his funeral that he came to her. Because the police were saying no crime scene, no witnesses, no suspects. It's going to be a cold case. So Tommy came to her early morning. You've got to go. This is where you're going to find my blood in the snow. But you've got to go now because it's melting. And by tomorrow afternoon, it'll be gone, so you've got to go right now. Well, Beverly's family was there, and of course, she went downstairs when she told them. They said, you're crazy with grief, go back upstairs. But no, they got in the car, and they went to the exact location. Tommy gave them the corner, and there, in the snow, was his blood. Now, here's the thing, is the police came out. Sure enough, it was Tommy's blood. They found three eyewitnesses right there where he had been killed.
Isn't that amazing?
So I love that story.
He solved his own problem, his own dilemma.
That's right. Now, what I would love, if there's somebody out there listening to this who can help Beverly, it did wind up being a cold case, but not because she didn't have the evidence, but because just a series of events with her private investigator got married and baby and moved off, and so Tommy's case fell through the cracks. We have turned to lawyers. I have called private investigators. I've tried to get everything I can to help her open the case, but it's 13 years old. Nobody wants to fool with it. And two, it was in a really, really bad part of Brooklyn. They tell me it's very dangerous there.
You said earlier that we don't really have the facts to, convince everybody that this is real, that this happens. What's your personal belief now based on your years of experience?
I do believe consciousness survives bodily death. Where it goes and for how long, I'm not so sure. But in my work, survival is not the focus. Mediums make up all these, what I thought were just extraordinary claims. Mm-hmm. I thought they were exaggerated claims for how comforting afterlife encounters are. And I was concerned that those claims were so exaggerated. So I turned to a leading specialist in the field of bereavement and parapsychology. And no study had ever been done that specifically focused on comfort or grief. And that's why I developed the Afterlife Encounter Survey, the study that I mentioned earlier, the 5-year international survey.
And so you can conclude that with these afterlife encounters, most people who are grieving tend to get better. The pain seems to go away.
Absolutely, George. What we found is that 83% said that their comfort was so tremendous, they rated it between 8 and 10 on the comfort scale, 83% of people who had afterlife encounters. And they said, as far as grief, no. Their grief did not extinguish, but, oh, gosh, it helped them carry the burden of their load.
But not everybody who knows someone who's dead has an encounter, right?
True. That's like I was mentioning earlier, of 28% of the survey respondents had never had anything close to an afterlife encounter. Yet they said they just had this intense and extended longing for so long.
Diane, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll talk more about this, afterlife encounters. A little bit later on, we'll open up the phone lines. Maybe you can share one of your stories with us when we come back as well about just what it was like to have an encounter. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Diane Archangel on Coast to Coast AM.